32. Theremin had never been much of an outdoorsman. He thought of himself as a city boy through and through. Grass, trees, fresh air, the open sky, he didn't actually mind them, but they held no particular appeal for him. For years, his life had shuttled along a fixed, urban-based, triangular orbit, rigidly following a familiar path bounded at one corner by his little apartment, at another by the Chronicle office, by the Six Suns Club at the third. Now, suddenly, he was a forest dweller. The strange thing was that he almost liked it. What the citizens of Sorrow City called the forest was actually a fair-sized woodsy tract that began just southeast of the city itself and stretched for a dozen miles or so along the south bank of the Sepotan River. There once had been a great deal more of it, a vast wilderness sweeping on a great diagonal across the midsection of the province, almost to the sea. But most of it had gone to agriculture. Much of the remainder had been cut up into suburban residential districts, and the university had taken a goodly nip some 50 years back for what was then its new campus. Unwilling to have itself engulfed by urban development, the university had then agitated to have what was left set aside as a park preserve. And since the rule in Sorrow City for many years had been that whatever the university wanted, the university usually got, the last strip of the old wilderness was left alone. That was where Theremin found himself living now. The first 2 days had been very bad. His mind was still half-fogged by the effects of seeing the stars, and he was unable to form any clear plan. The main thing was just to stay alive. The city was on fire. Smoke was everywhere. The air was scorching hot. From certain vantage points, you could even see the leaping flames dancing along the rooftops. So, obviously, it wasn't a good idea to try to go back there. In the aftermath of the eclipse, once the chaos within his mind had begun to clear a little, he had simply continued downhill from the campus until he found himself entering the forest. Many others plainly had done the same thing. Some of them looked like university people. Others were probably remnants of the mob that had come out to storm the observatory on the night of the eclipse. And the rest, Theremin guessed, were suburbanites, driven from their homes when the fires began to break out. Everyone he saw appeared to be at least as unsettled mentally as he was. Most seemed very much worse off, some of them completely unhinged, totally unable to cope. They had not formed any sort of coherent bands. Mainly they were solitaries, moving on mysterious private tracks through the woods, or else groups of two or three. The biggest aggregation Theremin saw was 8 people who, from their appearance and dress, seemed all to be members of one family. It was horrifying to encounter the truly crazy ones, the vacant eyes, the drooling lips, the slack jaws, the smeared clothing. They plodded through the forest glades like the walking dead, talking to themselves, singing, occasionally dropping to their hands and knees to dig up clumps of sod and munch on them. They were everywhere. The place was like one vast insane asylum, Theremin thought. Probably the whole world was. Those of this sort, the ones who had been most affected by the coming of the stars, were generally harmless, at least to others. They were too badly deranged to have any interest in being violent, and their bodily coordination was so seriously disrupted that effective violence was impossible for them anyway. But there were others who were not quite so mad, who at a glance might seem almost normal, who posed very serious dangers indeed. These, Theremin quickly realized, fell into 2 categories. The first consisted of people who bore no one any ill will, but who were hysterically obsessed with the possibility that the darkness and the stars might return. These were the firelighters. Very likely they were people who had led orderly, settled lives before the catastrophe. Family folk, hard workers, pleasant, cheerful neighbors. So long as Onos was in the sky, they were perfectly calm. But the moment the primary sun began to sink in the west and evening approached, fear of darkness overcame them, and they looked around desperately for something to burn, anything, anything at all. 2 or 3 of the other suns might still be overhead when Onos set, but the light of the minor suns did not seem sufficient to soothe the raging dread of darkness that these people felt. These were the ones who had burned their own city down around themselves, who in their desperation had ignited books, papers, furniture, the roofs of houses. Now driven into the forest by the Holocaust in the city, they were trying to burn that down too. But that was a harder job. The forest was densely wooded, lush, its thick cover of trees well supplied by the myriad streams that flowed into the broad river running along its border. Pulling down green boughs and trying to set them afire did not provide very satisfactory blazes. As for the carpet of dead wood and fallen leaves that lay on the forest floor, it had been pretty well soaked by the recent rains. Such of it that was capable of being burned was quickly found and used for bonfires, without touching off any sort of general conflagration, and by the second day the supply of such debris was very sparse. So the firelighter people, hampered as they were by forest conditions and by their own shock-muddled minds, were having little success so far, but they had managed to start a couple of good-sized fires in the forest all the same, which fortunately had burned themselves out in a few hours, because they had consumed all the fuel in their vicinity. A few days of hot, dry weather, though, and these people might well be able to set the whole place ablaze, as they had already done in Sorrow City. The second group of not-quite-stable people roaming the forest seemed to Theramin to be a more immediate menace. These were the ones who had let all social restraints fall away from them. They were the banditti, the hooligans, the cutthroats, the psychopaths, the homicidal maniacs, the ones who moved like unsheathed blades along the quiet forest pathways, striking whenever they pleased, taking whatever they wanted, killing anyone unlucky enough to arouse their irritation. Since everyone had a certain glazed look in his eyes, some merely from fatigue, others from despondency, and others from madness, you could never be sure, whenever you met someone in the forest, how dangerous he was. There was no way of telling at a quick glance whether the person approaching you was merely one of the distraught or bewildered crazies and therefore basically harmless, or one of the kind who were full of lethal fury and attacked anyone they encountered with neither rhyme nor reason behind their deeds. So you quickly learned to be on your guard against anyone who came prancing and swaggering through the woods. Any stranger at all could be a menace. You might be talking quite amiably with someone, comparing notes on your experiences since the evening of nightfall, when abruptly he would take offense at some casual remark of yours, or decide that he admired some article of your clothing, or perhaps merely take a blind, unreasoning dislike of your face, and with an animal-like howl he would come rushing at you in mindless ferocity. Some of this sort, no doubt, had been criminals to begin with. The sight of society collapsing all around them had freed them of all restraint. But others, Theramin suspected, had been placid enough folk until their minds were shattered by the stars. Then, suddenly, they found all the inhibitions of civilized life fall away from them. They forgot the rules that made civilized life possible. They were like small children again, asocial, concerned only with their own needs. But they had the strength of adults and the willpower of the deeply disturbed. The thing to do if you hoped to survive was to avoid those whom you knew to be lethally crazy or suspected of it. The thing to pray for was that they would all kill each other off within the first few days, leaving the world safe for the less predatory. Theramin had three encounters with madmen of this terrifying breed in the first 2 days. The first one, a tall, rangy man with a weird, diabolical grin who was cavorting by the side of a brook that Theramin wanted to cross, demanded that the newspaper man pay him a toll to go past.
"Your shoes, let's say, or how about that wristwatch?"
"How about getting out of my way?" Theramin suggested, and the man went berserk. Snatching up a cudgel that Theramin hadn't noticed until that moment, he roared some sort of war cry and charged. There was no time to take evasive action. The best Theramin could do was duck as the man swung the cudgel with horrific force at his head. He heard the club go whirring by, missing him by inches. It hit the tree beside him instead, cracking into it with tremendous force. A force so great that the impact of it traveled up the attacker's arm and he gasped in pain as the cudgel fell from his nerveless fingers. Theramin was on top of him in an instant, seizing the man's injured arm, bringing it sharply upward with merciless force, making him grunt in agony and double up and fall moaning to his knees. Theramin prodded and pushed him down until his face was in the stream and held him there. And held him there. And held him there. How simple it would be, Theramin thought in wonder, just to go on holding his head underwater until he drowned. A part of his mind was actually arguing in favor of it. "He would have killed you, without even thinking about it. Get rid of him. Otherwise, what will you do once you let go of him? Fight him all over again? What if he follows you through the forest to get even with you? Drown him now, Theramin, drown him!" It was a powerful temptation. But only one segment of Theramin's mind was willing to adapt so readily to the world's new jungle morality. The rest of him recoiled at the idea. And finally, he released the man's arm and stepped back. He picked up the fallen cudgel and waited. All the fight was gone from the other man now, though. Choking and gasping, he rose from the stream with water flowing from his mouth and nostrils and sat trembling by the bank, shivering, coughing, struggling for breath. He stared sullenly and fearfully at Theramin, but he made no attempt to get up, let alone to renew the fighting. Theramin stepped around him, crossed the stream in a bound, and trotted off quickly deeper into the forest. The implications of what he had almost done did not fully strike him for another 10 minutes. Then he halted suddenly in a burst of sweat and nausea and was swept by a fierce attack of vomiting that racked him so savagely that it was a long while before he could rise. Later that afternoon, he realized that his roamings had brought him right to the border of the forest. When he looked out between the trees, he saw a highway, utterly deserted, and on the far side of the road, the ruins of a tall brick building standing in a broad plaza. He recognized the building. It was the Pantheon, the cathedral of all the gods. There wasn't much left of it. He walked across the road and stared in disbelief. It looked as if a fire had started in the heart of the building. What had they been doing, using the pews for kindling? And had swept right up the narrow tower over the altar, igniting the wooden beams. The whole tower had toppled, bringing down the walls. Bricks were strewn everywhere about the plaza. He saw bodies jutting out of the wreckage. Theramin had never been a particularly religious man. He didn't know anyone who was. Like everyone else, he said things like, "My God," or "Gods," or "Great Gods," for emphasis. But the idea that there might actually be a god, or gods, or whatever the current prevailing belief system asserted, had always been irrelevant to the way he lived his life. Religion seemed like something medieval to him, quaint and archaic. Now and then he would find himself in a church to attend the wedding of a friend, who was as much of a disbeliever as he was, of course, or else he went to cover some official rite as a news item, but he hadn't been inside any kind of holy building for religious purposes since his own confirmation when he was 10 years old. All the same, the sight of the ruined cathedral stirred him profoundly. He had been present at its dedication 12 years back when he was a young reporter. He knew how many millions of credits the building had cost. He had marveled at the splendid works of art it contained. He had been moved by the marvelous music of Gisimol's Hymn to the Gods as it resounded through the great hall. Even he, who had no belief in the sacred, could not help feeling that if there was any place on Kalgash where the gods truly were present, it must be here. And the gods had let the building be destroyed like this. The gods had sent the stars, knowing that the madness to follow would wreck even their own pantheon. What did that mean? What did that say about the unknowability and unfathomability of the gods, assuming they even existed? No one would ever rebuild this cathedral, Theramin knew. Nothing would ever be as it was.
"Help me,"
a voice called. That feeble sound cut into Theramin's meditations. He looked around.
"Over here. Here."
To his left, yes. Theramin saw the glint of golden vestments in the sunlight. A man half buried in the rubble, far along down the side of the building. One of the priests, apparently, judging by his rich garb. He was pinned below the waist by a heavy beam and was gesturing with what must be the last of his strength. Theramin started to go toward him, but before he could take more than 12 steps, a second figure appeared at the far end of the fallen building and came running forward. A lean, agile little man who went scrambling over the bricks with animal swiftness, heading for the trapped priest. "Good," Theramin thought. "Together we ought to be able to pull that beam off him." But when he was still some 20 feet away, he halted, horror-stricken. The agile little man had already reached the priest. Bending over him, he had slit the priest's throat with one quick stroke of a small knife, as casually as one might open an envelope. And now he was busily engaged in slicing the cords that fastened the priest's rich vestments. He looked up, glaring at Theramin. His eyes were fiery and appalling.
"Mine,"
he growled like a jungle beast.
"Mine."
And he flourished the knife. Theramin shivered. For a long moment he stood frozen in his tracks, fascinated in a ghastly way by the efficient manner with which the looter was stripping the dead priest's body. Then, sadly, he turned and hurried away, back across the road into the forest. There was no point in doing anything else. That evening, when Tano and Sitha and Dovim held the sky with their melancholy light, Theramin allowed himself a few hours of fragmentary sleep in a deep thicket. But he awoke again and again, imagining that some madman with a knife was creeping up on him to steal his shoes. Sleep left him long before Onus rise. It seemed almost surprising to find himself still alive when morning finally came. Half a day later, he had his third encounter with one of the new breed of killers. This time he was crossing a grassy meadow close by one of the arms of the river when he caught sight of two men sitting in a shady patch just across the way, playing some sort of game with dice. They looked calm and peaceful enough. But as Theramin came nearer, he realized that an argument had broken out. And then, unthinkably swiftly, one of the men snatched up a bread knife sitting on the blanket beside him and plunged it with lethal force into the other man's chest. The one who had wielded the knife smiled across at Theremin.
He cheated me. You know how it is. It makes you damned angry. I can't stand it when a guy tries to cheat me.
It seemed all very clear-cut to him. He grinned and rattled the dice.
Hey, you want to play?
Theremin stared into the eyes of madness. Sorry, he said as casually as he could. I'm looking for my girlfriend. He kept on walking.
Hey, you can find her later. Come on and play.
I think I see her, Theremin called, moving faster and got out of there without looking back. After that, he was less cavalier about wandering through the forest. He found a sheltered nook in what seemed like a relatively unoccupied glade and built a tidy little nest for himself under a jutting overhang. There was a berry bush nearby that was heavily laden with edible red fruits, and when he shook the tree just opposite his shelter, it showered him with round yellow nuts that contained a tasty dark kernel. He studied the small stream just beyond, wondering if it contained anything edible that he might catch. But there seemed to be nothing in it except tiny minnows, and he realized that even if he could catch them, he would have to eat them raw, for he had nothing to use as fuel for a fire and no way of lighting one besides. Living on berries and nuts wasn't Theremin's idea of high style, but he could tolerate it for a few days. Already his waistline was shrinking commendably, the only admirable side effect of the whole calamity. Best to stay hidden away back here until things calmed down. He was pretty sure that things would calm down. General sanity was bound to return sooner or later, or so he hoped at least. He knew that he himself had come a long way back from the early moments of chaos that the sight of the stars had induced in his brain. Every day that went by, he felt more stable, more capable of coping. It seemed to him that he was almost his old self again, still a little shaky, perhaps a little jumpy, but that was only to be expected. At least he felt fundamentally sane. He realized that very likely he had less of a jolt during nightfall than most people, that he was more resilient, more tough-minded, better able to withstand the fearful impact of that shattering experience. But maybe everybody else would start recovering too, even those who had been much more deeply affected than he had been. And then it would be safe to emerge and see what, if anything, was being done about trying to put the world back together. The thing to do now, he told himself, was to lay low, to keep from getting yourself murdered by one of those psychopaths running around out there. Let them all do each other in as fast as they could, and then he would come warily creeping out to find out what was going on. It wasn't a particularly courageous plan, but it seemed like a wise one. He wondered what had happened to the others who had been in the observatory with him at the moment of darkness, to Bine, to Shirin, to Aethor, to Sephera, especially to Sephera. From time to time, Theremin thought of venturing out to look for her. It was an appealing idea. During his long hours of solitude, he spun glowing fantasies for himself of what it would be like to hook up with her somewhere in this forest. The two of them, journeying together through this transformed and frightening world, forming an alliance of mutual protection. He had been attracted to her from the first, of course. For all the good that had done him, he might just as well not have bothered, he knew. Handsome as she was, she seemed to be the sort of woman who was absolutely self-contained, in no need whatever of any man's company, or any woman's for that matter. He had maneuvered her into going out with him now and then, but she had efficiently and serenely kept him at a safe distance all the time. Theremin was experienced enough in worldly things to understand that no amount of smooth talk was persuasive enough to break through barriers that were so determinedly maintained. He had long ago decided that no worthwhile woman could ever be seduced. You could present the possibility to them, but you had to leave it ultimately to them to do the seducing for you, and if they weren't so minded, there was very little you could do to change their outlook. And with Sephera, things had been sliding in the wrong direction for him all year long. She had turned on him ferociously, and with some justification, he thought ruefully, once he began his misguided campaign of mockery against Aethor and the observatory group. Somehow, right at the end, he had felt that she was weakening, that she was becoming interested in him despite herself. Why else had she invited him to the observatory, against Aethor's heated orders, on the evening of the eclipse? For a short time that evening there had actually seemed to be real contact blossoming between them. But then had come the darkness, the stars, the mob, the chaos. After that everything had plunged into confusion. But if he could find her somehow, now, we'd work well together, he thought. We'd be a tremendous team. Hard-nosed, competent, survival-oriented, Whatever kind of civilization is going to evolve, we'd find a good place for ourselves in it. And if there had been a little psychological barrier between them before, he was certain it would seem unimportant to her now. It was a brand new world, and new attitudes were necessary if he were going to survive. But how could he find Sephira? No communication circuits were open, as far as he knew. She was just one of millions of people at large in the area. The forest alone probably had a population of many thousands now, and he had no real reason for assuming that she was in the forest. She could be 50 miles from here by this time. She could be dead. Looking for her was a hopeless task. It was worse than trying to find the proverbial needle in a haystack. This haystack was several counties wide, and the needle might well be getting farther away every hour. Only by the wildest sort of coincidence could he ever locate Sephira, or for that matter, anyone else he knew. The more Theramon thought about his chances of finding her, though, the less impossible the task seemed, and after a while it began to seem quite possible indeed. Perhaps his steadily rising optimism was a byproduct of his new, secluded life. He had nothing to do but spend hours each day sitting by the brook, watching the minnows go by, and thinking. And as he endlessly reevaluated things, finding Sephira went from seeming impossible to merely unlikely, and from unlikely to difficult, and from difficult to challenging, and from challenging to feasible, and from feasible to readily achievable. All he had to do, he told himself, was get back out into the forest and recruit a little help from those who were reasonably functional. Tell them who he was trying to find and what she looked like. Spread the word around. Employ some of his journalistic skills. And make use of his status as a local celebrity. "I'm Theramon 762, he would say. "You know, from the Chronicle. Help me and I'll make it worth your while. You want your name in the paper? You want me to make you famous? I can do it. Never mind that the paper isn't being published just now. Sooner or later it'll be back, and I'll be right there with it. And you'll see yourself smack in the middle of the front page. You can count on that. Just help me find this woman that I'm looking for, and..."
"Theramon?"
A familiar voice, high-pitched, cheerful. He stopped short, squinted into the brightness of the midday sunlight cutting through the trees, peered this way and that to locate the speaker. He had been walking for 2 hours, looking for people who would be glad to get out there and spread the word on behalf of the famous Theramon 762 of the Sorrow City Chronicle. But so far he had found only 6 people altogether. 2 of them had taken to their heels the moment they saw him. A third sat where he was, singing softly to his bare toes. Another, crouching in the fork of a tree, methodically rubbed 2 kitchen knives together with maniacal zeal. The remaining 2 had simply stared at him when he told them what he wanted. 1 did not seem to understand at all, and the other burst into gales of wild laughter. Not much hope of help from any of them. And now it appeared that someone had found him.
"Theramon, over here! Over here, Theramon! Here I am! Don't you see me, man? Over here!"